Okay.
So have you all started looking at assignment 3 yet?
Hmm? No, that's... So you've already gotten a bit of an idea with assignment 3 in the, you know, last tutorial, which was before the break. In this next tutorial, that will be... Okay. If anyone can send a message saying that the tel service, I think.
Somebody probably has.
If anyone can send a message to them, I'd most appreciate it. Anyway, so you've seen the assignment, you've seen the first tutorial, you've got some idea of what's in there. The key thing, though, with that we haven't covered is some asynchronous stuff. In particular, you're going to have to use some AJAX calls in your assignment. So the plan is, I'm working my way up to AJAX. I don't think we're going to cover it today, but in tutorial this Friday, I will give you some examples of jQuery and AJAX for you to, that should help you with your assignment. So, I think you could probably look stuff up if you want to, but otherwise I will give you example code, which should make it a good bit easier. So, what I want to talk about today, though, is I seem to recall myself talking about sandboxes last time. I may stop periodically and scowl at the outside, going like... So, when you say a sandbox, we're talking about an isolated environment for running code, where the code is going to run on a system, but it has limited access to things outside of its little sandbox, so that when it, so if it tries escaping, well, if it makes a mess, we can clean up easily, undo the damage, and things are back the way they were. So your browser implements a variety of sandboxes for running the content that you get from outside websites. Now, what I want to talk about is the Java sandbox versus the sandbox for JavaScript. So the key difference, I was saying, for a person in this class between Java and JavaScript. Oh, thank you. The key difference between Java and JavaScript was this notion of code-centric or data-centric language, that with JavaScript, the code goes to the data and has to work with what the data is in the form of the web page, at least originally, and Java, it's always the programmer has their code and the data gets squished in there as the programmer deems fit. This has implications for the sandbox. Because remember, the sandbox for... So if this was a Java applet, or this is a Flash program. So here is your applet. Well, we'll see. What can this applet do? Can it access the rest of the page? In general, no. In general, it's isolated to there. It's running in its own little confined space. There's a very specific browser extension API, the plugin API, that allows... gives it very limited access to the browser. It can do a few things, but not that much. But you downloaded code here. How else is it restricted? So this is talking about the graphical interface. What can it access on the local system? Can it access the file system? No. So applet restrictions. Only portion of screen. No file IO. So So you can access this machine. What are other machines? What can it access?
Can it access the rest of the internet? Yeah, just grab whatever it wants for anywhere.
Can it do anything with anything it can grab from the internet?
Well,
if it doesn't have any access to the files, if it can't save any files, then what would it do with anything from the internet?
Well, why does it have to save it locally? Why can't it save it remotely? It can always use it like a remote file system. But the fact is, a Java applet, same origin policy for the network. Who here has heard this term, same origin policy? I'm just kind of curious, does this ring any bells? So the idea of same origin policy is saying that you download a program from the internet, it can't just access anything on the internet. Because that would almost be like a botnet on demand. You just download some code and it starts like scanning your network and downloading things, who knows what. I mean, it's, if you think about it for a few seconds, you realize downloading arbitrary code that can talk on the network and do whatever it wants is kind of dangerous. So the basic restriction that was placed at the beginning of the web was the idea of same origin policy, which says that the applet can only talk to the server from which it was downloaded. It can phone home, but it can't talk arbitrarily. It has to go back to the same origin. Now, that's broadly what it was. Of course, there were always little exceptions, like you could say, you go back to your origin or to the parent domain. So example, let's say you go to mail.carlton.ca. Let's say there was a subdomain there. It was set. Well, you could potentially also access things at carlton.ca. You could strip off portions and also access that. So that's same origin policy. Turns out was not completely well defined at the beginning, and now it's kind of ambiguous and actually weakening over time. But the original idea was that this is, you can only talk to your original server. This is to restrict the functionality of that code. This is the policy for Java applets. This is the policy for Flash. And it is also the policy for JavaScript. But you should think a little bit about this for a second. We'll talk about this more, but JavaScript can also do arbitrary web stuff. It can embed images because it can manipulate the DOM of the page, so it can do anything that HTML can do. You can have an image in there, you can add some text, you can grab so you can grab things from other servers, you can make requests, but they're kind of restricted in theory and programmatically for JavaScript. Now, what I'm going to say is there is an exception for this if you're talking about Java applets. You all have been around long enough. You've all used WebCT, right? WebCT, if you notice, when you wanted to upload applications, I think also Raven, I think, but so those had Java applets inside them. But those Java applets could access your local files, right? They had old little Apple uploaders for saying, oh, I want to upload this file, you select this, and it sent it off, right? I just told you an applet doesn't have access to local files, so am I lying? Well, I'm simplifying. So what I'm talking about here is this is untrusted. Untrusted applets are like this. And originally, all applets were untrusted. But then they came along with this idea that, well, maybe we should trust these things. Because wouldn't it be nice if you could download a program and it could rummage through your local file system? Thay to find pictures to upload. So who do you trust?
The browser?
I just downloaded this code. My browser can access my local files, but I don't always, I mean, assuming my browser doesn't have any errors, and actually sometimes browsers are running restricted environments because they can be compromised, but so not quite. Yes?
How, you're not, uploading a file is not really that, not extending that much trust. You're only extending it read permission. You're not saying, oh, and yeah, you can write, overwrite, or you can, you're just saying, okay, here's some data I want to send.
So the issue is if you only allow a applet to access one file, so there's always been the upload part of the HTTP spec. You can, as part of a post command, you can include a file and have it upload to the server. What you typically have the Java applets used is you want to upload multiple files. You want some sort of nice interface for accessing. And so in order for something to upload multiple files, you essentially have to give it access to your file system. You're saying now this can do arbitrary things with your file system as you. So it's potentially dangerous. Untrusted Java applets. I just gave it away. Darn it. So untrusted Java applets cannot do this. But if an applet comes down and is signed, it can access stuff. We actually have discussed digital signatures a little bit, and now this is a good time to talk about them again. So when we say a digital signature, what does that mean? So when you say digital signature, is a digital signature, are we talking about a little picture of the signature that you wrote on the page? No. We're talking math. We're talking public signature or certificate. Certificates are containers for digital signatures. But people often... I'm confusing terms. These are separate terms. Let me try to give you I just want to give you a quick little thing. Otherwise, I'd spend this whole lecture describing digital signatures. And we've already talked about it a little bit. That still might be worthwhile. So let's say I have a document. It's a bunch of data. I want to send this. So we have party A, Alice, and we have Bob. A wants to send, we'll call this a document D. A wants to send it to B. So A sends document D, B receives document D prime. And the question is, how does B know that document D prime is actually document D? Specifically, it's the document that A sent, and it has not been modified. How do you know that? You're thinking along the right lines, and that's part of it. But a digital signature is, you know, we use a public-private key pair plus a hash. So one way to compare these two is to use, so you all saw this when you downloaded the ISO image. Well, how many of you downloaded the ISO images? I don't know, for the class VM. So you saw when I had the class VM, I said, here is the SHA-1 sum. SHA-1 SUN was a cryptographic hash of that file. And so you, so there is, so you have H of D prime, and you have H of D. If I can check that D prime, H of D prime is equal to H of D, then I have, because of the properties of these cryptographic hash functions, I have high assurance that D and D prime are bit for bit identical. So how do I check the hash in the case of this? Well, one hash I got from the web page, I looked at it. The other hash I got from downloading the file, running the algorithm on it, SHA-1 SUM, or I think there was a Windows equivalent I gave you a link to. You run that and it calculates it on the file. So the one I've calculated locally on the one on the file I downloaded, loaded compared with the hash that I see on the web page, if the numbers match, I believe I have the right document. There's just one problem. What if someone was doing an attack on my network connection and rewrote the web page as it went to my browser and changed the hash? You might say, that's paranoid talk.
I was just going to say that you're really, really unlucky.
No, actually, it's actually quite realistic nowadays. These kind of attacks and stuff happen much more frequently than you think. Because it's called a man-in-the-middle attack, and if you can start, if you know where they're going to go to check something, I mean, it might sound like something out of like the old Mission Impossible or something. They call up for verification, or they intercept the phone call, saying like, is this really someone from that business? And it's like, yes, that is. We just sent someone over. In fact, they did. That's the kind of attack we're talking about, but that's feasible in a number of circumstances. Either directly online or through other ways. And so a digital signature is designed to deal with that. So you take this hash and we need some way of verifying the hash. Now, you might say, well, if I can verify the hash, why didn't I just verify the file? Well, the file is arbitrary size. It might be gigabytes in size, and I'll tell you this, trying to run public key algorithms on documents that are gigabytes in size is a bad, bad idea. Hash algorithms are fast. Also, it shows that there's security implications of that. So what you instead do is you run the, you want to process the hashes, which are nice, small, fixed size things, like 160 bits, 256 bits, something nice and small. And that's what you want to make sure you have. So, while there are other algorithms that can do it in some different ways, to a first approximation, what you do is you encrypt this to do a digital signature. The sender encrypts with their public key. No, sorry, their private key, sorry. So if I encrypt something with my private key, who can decrypt it?
Person receiving it, I guess?
Well, remember when you have a public-private key pair, whatever the public key does, the private key can undo. Whatever the private key does, the public key can undo. They can reverse each other. So if I do an operation with the private key, it can be undone using the public key. Public key is public. Post on your web page, distribute to everyone, give it away, la-di-da. Here are the public keys. So if I have a public key that's available, what's the use of encrypting it with the private key if anyone in the world can decrypt it? Remember, our goal here is not secrecy. Our goal here is authenticity. So what we'll say is, let's say we have a public-private key pair. We'll call it some secret Yeah, I'll say, yeah. I try secret, and I will say, yeah, my notation's a little annoying there. But we'll say S and P for secret and public. So we do a piece of S on H of D. So this produces, we'll say this is equal to the, this is your, we'll call this S. So this is your signature. I have to send the signature over here. If I process the signature and I do, what's P of what will this give? P of PS will give me the hash. Right? These are mirrors. So if I encrypt it using the secret key file, the private key, I get an S, I then send the S over, and the other side, B, can decrypt it using the public key and get the hash back. Notice now they have this hash, which I had before gotten from a web page. I now got it in encrypted form and decrypted. But because it came in encrypted form and it decrypted properly, I know that it only could have come from someone who had a piece of S. Since I know it only came from someone with a piece of S, I now know, okay, not only do I have the hash, I have the hash that came to the right person. Well, what I have is I have the hash that it was, the hash was produced by someone who had this secret key, which corresponds to this public key. And now the question comes, how do I know I have the right public key? You should get a feeling of deja vu at this point. Right? It's exactly the same problem that I had with trying to make sure I had the right hashes. Except instead of the file being transferred, now I have this public key being transferred. How do I know I got the right public key? You get it, son. You have signatures on public keys. When we talk about certificates, certificates are public keys plus metadata, such as who belongs to the public key, along with signatures of the public key.
If something was encrypted by their private key, and you want to check if you have their public key, well, if your public key doesn't work to decrypt it, then you know it's not their public key.
Well, you know, or you know that this, whoever, this was signed by another key.
Yeah.
That's all you know. It's, basically, it's crap. You just ignore it. You know, it's, only if you have a verified, you know, only if the thing, everything checks out do you have any guarantees. You don't have partial guarantees. But you should see here a little bit of the problem of cryptography, of public key crypto in particular. It's that in order for me to check a document, I have to have the right public key. In order for you to make sure that you got email from me and that it didn't come from anyone else, you have to have my public key. How do you know you have my public key? We might say, well, I gave it to you. Maybe I gave it to you on a piece of paper. Or maybe I talked to you on the phone and I gave it to you. Or maybe I just talked to you on the phone and I gave you the hash. Y'all heard of, did Andy talk about PGP signing parties?
What is the letters?
PGP or GPG. GPG is the open source version of PGP. Pretty good privacy, good in privacy guard.
I remember hearing those letters when she was.
So the command that we were using was GPG. So you go to these signing parties, the whole idea of this is to say, how do I know I have the right public keys? So I will go and I will meet you in person. I'll look at your driver's license or passport or something, and I'll see, do you seem like a nice person? Do you sound like you're the person who I've been corresponding with the past couple of years online or something? And then, okay, I will sign your key. That means my key is now pledging to say that I believe you are who you are, and I have signed your key, so now I am vouching for you. Now, if any of my friends see stuff signed by you, they might believe it because they're taking me at my word. And I wouldn't foolishly sign anyone's public key that, you know, I didn't trust. So no drunk signing. Not recommended. So why I mention all this in the context of talking about the sandbox and talking about signed applets is all we're talking about with a signed Java applet is that your computer downloads, the applet comes with a digital signature. That digital signature is signed by a public key. And I don't know if you all recall, like the public key would typically be like from Blackboard. Like, this applet has been signed by Blackboard. And then you go like, how does your browser know this applet was signed by Blackboard? The key that came down for signing it said it was from Blackboard. How do you know that was come from someone else? How do you know that really came from Blackboard? Does anyone know how this bottoms out?
You get a third party organization who got it to vouch for key.
It's called,
authorized issuers of certificates.
Yep. They're called CAs, certificate authorities. Your browser has built in, and your operating system has built in, some set of certificates which represent the trusted public keys. If those public keys have signed a certificate, you trust it. Because they know what they're doing, and they are completely trustworthy, and they'd never do anything wrong.
I'm guessing
right?
You're being sarcastic.
How many organizations do you think your computer trusts? How many think your browser trusts?
It don't mean manufacturer.
Huh? But just get order of magnitude. 5? 10? Hundreds.
Exponential.
In your current browser, you can go into, you can get a list. By going through the options, you can see the number of certificate authorities in your browser. I should put that into the tutorial so you can see how many there are. You'll typically find a couple hundred keys at least. Chrome has its own built-in list. Firefox, I know, maintains its own list. I'm pretty sure Chrome does, but then also the operating systems maintain their own list. Microsoft has its own list that isn't just available to its browser, but it's also available to others. So when you have a signed applet, it's just saying that one of these certificate authorities has signed a certificate of this company or this organization that has signed this program. Yes?
Those certificates come with the browser, which you download. So
seeing a problem here, aren't we? Yeah. Yeah.
So the main solution is just ridiculous encapsulation of data and encryption and distributing all these policies and behaviors to certificate authorities, digital signatures to try and complicate the problem so much that you assume no one can break it.
Obfuscation, smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is So there's been a number. So what's to prevent you from going to a certificate authority and say, give me a certificate that says I'm Microsoft.com, please. Then I can sign my programs, and then when they show up in their, on their system, when they get downloaded, it'll say, because of course, this isn't just for Java applets. Every time you install a program on Windows or something, doesn't it now pop up? This program was produced by this, this came from Adobe. This came from Microsoft. Right? How does it trust that? It's because it's been signed. And so if I can just have this, some certificate authority say, sign this and say it's a certificate from Microsoft. And then when your program comes onto their system, it'll say, signed by Microsoft. See, it's a different key than the other Microsoft ones you've seen, but it says Microsoft, and so you trust it, right? There are a number of projects that are trying to
find ways to deal with this sort of issue. There are things like, let's look at the public keys that are used by lots of organizations, and let's see when different ones show up, and let's kind of see if this is a new one or an old one or something. Or, you know, Google's keeping track of these things, and there's all these kind of things. But ultimately, it's you can trust keys that you have verified. If it's signed by a key that you have not personally verified, its trustworthiness is always somewhat suspect. And so why do I download a program from the internet and just let it use my computer? Because it was signed. There's no real good reason other than blind faith in humanity. Yeah. Yes. You all have lived on the internet for long enough, you know about that. No, actually, I would say the fact that the internet works at all is a great testament to the fundamentally good nature of people. You might say that's a ridiculous statement, but trust me, can you know how much bad stuff could happen? With anyone who actually has a clue, you realize, wow, mostly this operates on trust. As in, I trust you're not going to try to run me over when I cross the street level of trust. And that generally works when you cross the street. And that's the same way the internet works. Don't let anyone else tell you otherwise. But oddly enough, regular browsers are not so gullible. The sandbox that you use for JavaScript does not allow for signed anything. There's no way to download a program and have it say, oh, I'm really trustworthy JavaScript program. I'm just going to access everything on your computer. This sort of silliness only came from these little embedded programs in your browser. They came from ActiveX controls first. Microsoft is the first one to blame for this. Because they started just doing ActiveX controls and saying, oh, I can just download arbitrary programs onto my computer. And as long as they're signed, they're trustworthy. That was ActiveX. And then Sun had to get in on the story and say, well, I can't allow functionality for ActiveX controls because they could do things that Java applets can do. So we'll introduce signed Java applets that can now do almost anything that an ActiveX control, and with all the security problems. The regular browser folks said, no, that's just dumb. So, no digital signatures on code, on JavaScript code that you download into your browser. So I call that good news. So that means, though, that you have to live with these restrictions. You have to say, you're not doing file IO. The only portion of the screen, you can only access what's in the browser window. You can't just look around on the whole screen. You can only talk to your main server. Now, the good news and bad news is that web developers are ambitious. What does that mean? That means web developers keep wanting to do more and more stuff. Which means that these policies are slowly being dismantled, piece by piece. When you look at HTML5, you'll notice that it has certain extensions, things like local storage, where all of a sudden you can start storing arbitrary amounts of data in the browser. It's not full file system access, but oh, you're storing a lot more data. Okay. Then there's things like WebSockets, which let you start talking to arbitrary computers on the network. There's all the same origin policy is getting relaxed almost to the point of being non-existent in various ways. Execution-wise, you can now access more and more of the system's resources. You can do full graphics acceleration and stuff. You can access the sound. You can access random microphone sensors and things. So what I'm trying to say is the sandbox is taking over your whole computer. So that's potentially bad, but the good news is it means you could do lots of stuff inside the browser. Was it questions or was it... Yes.
Wasn't it possible to store data, sort of like on the on the local machine using cookies before HTML5?
Yes, yes. Cookies have always been there, but cookies were always small.
But aren't there also, like, long-term cookies?
They're long-term, but they're small.
You can have, like, big ones, though, because, like, how do some flash players store?
That's different. Flash has its own storage mechanism. See, that's what I was saying, is that like Flash has its own local storage mechanism, and now HTML5 is really trying to be able to get the capabilities of these other things, and so now it's allowing for arbitrary storage in the browser. So basically setting up your own kind of little per-domain file system, which is potentially useful if you want to cache data at your client. It's not bad. It's just saying that the sandbox is, everything you care about is inside the sandbox now. There's still restrictions on accessing local files, but really most of your life is inside of this thing. So web security is an ongoing and will be an ongoing issue.
Is there a limit to the number of cookies a website can give you?
There are limits. I don't know what the limits are. But I mean, cookies, you really can only store like tens of K of stuff. It's small. Mm-hmm.
I know for Firefox, for the HTML5, like the file saving, it'll actually pop up and prompt you if the file it's trying to save is over 50 meg.
50 meg?
Yeah, that's the limit I found.
That's the limit, okay.
So you have to approve it and it'll go through.
Okay. Wow. I remember when 50 megs was actually real storage. Yeah.
A lot of the things about security, nothing is ever completely secure if it's allowed to talk to anything. What security mostly does is make it too much of a hassle for any but the most determined to actually break it.
That's true, except if I can go to an online marketplace or a little forum and download this really sophisticated program that someone else has downloaded and just use it, that really determined hacker part only applies to the person developing the attacks, not to the people using them. So it's I can spend the rest of this class talking. I can spend the rest of this semester talking about security, but I just want to give you a little, just a little notion of this in the context of the design of the browser, which is saying that this is the restriction. So what I'm going to do now is take a pause, and we'll switch gears after the break. And what I want to talk to you about is jQuery. And kind of talk about what does it mean to interact with the DOM inside the browser. Let's get started. Good. Did I give long enough? So we started talking before about the document object. The document object model is a tree-like, basically a tree representation of the page. Remember, HTML consists of these attributes. This would be for a link. And of course you have these tags, these begin and end tags, and they're arbitrarily nested. And so if you parse these out, you see they form a tree. Because there's the head and there's a body, and you can you know, programmatically easily represent this. So instead of your program, JavaScript program, having to look at the raw text of the page, it just looks at the parsed version of this. So your program never actually sees like angle brackets and stuff. It sees the parsed version of these objects. Now, that wasn't actually the way things started. If you originally wanted to have your JavaScript modify the page, you'd just edit the page. There's a function called document.write. Well, with document.write, you could just write arbitrary text to the page. Does that kind of ugly? It is. In general, don't use it. I mention this now not because one trouble with web programming is that if you look online, you'll see stuff that dates back to 1995 if you're not careful. W3 schools in particular, some of that stuff's got a bit dated.
So if you see people saying, oh, the way you modify the web page is by using document.write, move on.
Wrong one. Next.
But now, if you want to modify,
so now it's a tree.
It's a tree with some structure. So now, here's your challenge. I want to modify this node.
How do I describe it? How do I talk about it? One thing you'd do is say, well, you'd say, well, if you go, you know, right, then left, you know, right, then right, that's the node I want. I don't want the one right, left, right, but I want the one right, right.
You know, I can tell it by how you traverse the tree. I could give reference to things. Does that sound like a very good idea?
No, that's not how we do things.
So, of course, what do we have to do? We have to label things. So, if you want to just refer to an individual node, you just need to give it an ID. Once you give it a name, give it an ID, you can refer to that ID in JavaScript code. And you'll notice in your JavaScript code, you'll see identifiers, which lets you refer to different parts of your DOM. So, but what if I don't want to refer to just one, just one particular node? What if I want to refer to a group of nodes? What if I want to refer to an entire arrow? What if I want to refer to, let's say I've got this, let's say these represent names. There's a name here, there's a name here and stuff. I don't want to give them each a name and then do that. I want to refer to them as a group. Exactly. It's exactly what you do, is you refer to by class. So when you look in HTML and you see tags be labeled with, you know, IDs or labeled with classes, what they're doing is they're providing names that are for later reference. CSS uses these names for defining styling. JavaScript can use these names for manipulating the DOM, for changing these attributes. One thing you might want to do is, in order to change how these nodes are displayed, you can just change their class under programmatic control. So now how do you, what sort of API do you have for this? Now, this is where JavaScript has gotten a particularly bad rap over the years. It's because the way of specifying things and talking about them in things like the DOM tree vary from browser to browser. They weren't completely consistent. They would have slightly different semantics. So one option is to write your own code that understands how every browser does things and has conditions for saying, if it's this browser, do this. If it's this browser, do this. But that's a good way to make everyone go crazy. So instead, we have libraries to take care of this mess for you. That's where jQuery comes in, is one of the most important ones. And you notice it's called jQuery. The reason why it's called jQuery, it's JavaScript query, because its structure is based around querying the DOM tree. What parts of the DOM tree are you going to talk about? And its syntax is dead simple. So first off, you start with this basic jQuery object, which you can refer to, I think, by jQuery, but you almost never do. You normally refer to it. By the way, anyone here who's an experienced web developer, if I make a mistake, feel free to correct me. That's fine. But you normally refer to it as dollar sign, because
because that is an unclaimed symbol in JavaScript, and so you can assign it to anything. And so the global dollar sign symbol is assigned to the jQuery object. And so if you want to do a query on your DOM tree, you just say, you say dollar and give it a string, whatever query you want, which basically means the ID you want of something, the class, or whatever property of the DOM tree, whatever subset you want to refer to. And there's actually a lot of ways of slicing and dicing this. Any way you basically want to, you can do it. You say this, give it the string, and it does what you want. But you say, but what do you mean it does what I want? Okay, I've got a query. Well, this returns to you a jQuery object that you has a variety of methods that you can call. And you know, these methods almost all translate one for one to standard browser methods, but sometimes there's a little bit of glue code to deal with incompatibilities and stuff, so it provides a standard interface. So it's not that it's that much harder. So I'm telling you the jQuery ways of doing things, but there are other ways of doing it. Like, for example, I want to define an event handler. So this is JavaScript. So what would an event handler look like? It looks like the things that are going to have the event associated with it. It's what the event is and what you do. What type? So what do you think the type is of the things that is that you're supposed to do on the event? This is not supposed to be a hard question.
JavaScript.
It's a function. You associate a function with an arbitrary event. So in jQuery parlance, most of this is a specified with a on. So let's say I make, so if I say by a query, I then get back, I say x. So now I have something, some set of the DOM tree. I have an x. I should say bar. Make it local, but whatever. I've got an x here. Now I want to specify an event. So I say dot on, and I give it two parameters. One is the event, and the other is the callback. The function. You tell it what event should I be waiting on, and what should the callback be? Looks kind of familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Should feel kind of, after playing with Node, this shouldn't look completely alien. The events are predefined, for the most part. You have all these things that the browser knows how to do. What sort of events do you expect there to be?
Click.
Click! You've seen some of these now. Things like, click the mouse, click, hover, you know, mouse, down, up, you know, you press the, you know, did you click the button and not let go? Did you let go of the button? Have you, you know, pressed it? There's all kinds of mouse movement, you know, key press. I forget some of the names of these. Honestly, for events, when you figure out the event you want, you look it up on the table to make sure you get the right name, unless you use these a lot. But basically, all the standard user interface kind of interactions you'd expect. There's also a whole other set of events for touch events. Because touchscreen events don't look exactly like mouse events. There are certain gestures you can get and other things, and so there's events for touch things on a touchscreen. There's ones for mouse movements, ones for the keyboard. And with each event, they'll have things, and you can associate the callback. Now, how do you think? Now, you think some of these events might actually have certain other things with them. Like, if there was a key press event, there's a key that got pressed. How do you think you know what key got pressed?
Specify a parameter to the callback function?
Yeah, well, the callback will take arguments. And that argument will be what happened. So you have to process that event record and say, oh, it was this kind of event, and so this happened, and so here's my character. Or here's the mouse coordinates. Or whatever. So there's, when the event happens, you don't specify that here, but in your callback function, it will have to process the details of the event. And again, this should look a lot like the kind of node code you've been playing with. Just that here the events are interface stuff. Now, are these the only events, though, that you might be interested in? Remember, we're living inside of a browser, so there's other events. What was it?
Load.
Load, yes. So there's things like, you know, load or onload. jQuery, I don't think, calls it onload, but, you know, the standard JavaScript is onload. Then there's things like resize.
All the window events, so open and dim.
Load, close. Resize.
It's typically ready for jQuery, I think.
When is the page ready for taking events? So the load one would happen when the page is first being loaded. The ready one was when everything has been loaded. Because it's a web page, it's potentially loading in lots of things, they aren't all ready at the same time. And some code you may want to run early, and other code you may want to run late. So you have these sort of events. So this, and has the window state changed? Those sort of things. And then when we start talking about, you know, Ajax type things, which I will talk about that next time, those correspond to more synthetic things of saying the server has sent you data. I forgot timers. So you can set a timer that says after so many milliseconds, call me, or every so many milliseconds. Now, people used to do this to, like, you know, refresh their page constantly and stuff, but with Ajax now we can do these queries in the background. But so this isn't, I don't think of this stuff as, I see this as lots of details, but I don't think conceptually it's that complicated. It's a question of how do you all know graphical user interfaces, you live with them, you know the kind of interactions, you've done some GUI programming, and so all those kind of interactions are there. And you can access them. That's why you can make this into an arbitrary interface. So using jQuery, we call this, we give it a query, it gives us back some part of the DOM tree, then based on that part of the DOM tree, we can do things like register events. So notice this can be an arbitrary parts of the DOM tree. So I can say this div tag, I care about click events here, versus this button, I care about click events, versus the entire page. Like, you can always specify events on the entire window object. So if you can do this different granularity, which one gets it? Because you can define overlap, like I can specify something that gets the key press handler on the innermost, on this little button, and also a general, press a key on the outer window, or...
It propagates.
Which means that it starts the most special... So what it really is doing is it takes the tree, it takes the most specific thing, and then tries to follow it up to the enclosing things. Now, this is also a place where browsers differ. Is exactly how the events are propagated through the DOM tree and which ones will be called in what order. That is mostly standardized now, but again, things like jQuery try to mask most of the differences between browsers so you don't have to worry about it. That's why it's nice to use these things. But these are just sort of issues you should... Whenever you start thinking about this doesn't matter as long as your events are mutually exclusive. But it only comes into play when you start saying, well, I specified a mouse event handler here and a mouse event handler here, and this is a subset of that, and so which one is going to come into play? Those are the times you have to pay attention to it, and you have to realize there might be some compatibilities. It's better to just make it so that there's more, they don't overlap so much. Or have a unified event handler that can know the different conditions. I might say, okay, I want to do different things. I have this big box, and I have a small box, and I have an event handler that will do something different in these two. Instead of trying two event handlers, I define one on the larger thing, and I notice when it's inside of here, I do something different. If the semantics are ambiguous, beware allowing the browser to make the decision for you. It's a general notion of portability. So if you look at the code that I gave you last Friday, it had things like add event listener instead of on. Add event listener is actually relatively standard. You can probably use that without much problem, but one thing I'm going to want you to do in the lab is convert it to use jQuery's versions of things. So you can kind of see both ways. Because I mean, if you go online, you'll find some people saying, but if you use jQuery, it'll be slower. Technically, yes. But if you really need to optimize for that, you can later take away the jQuery code and replace it with native code. And don't do premature optimization. Only optimize things when you know there's a problem. You've all heard this rule, right? Optimization? Premature optimization? Raise your hand if you have heard this. Okay, not that many. So, basic rule of optimization, when you're trying to make your program fast, is you don't start off and say, I want my program to be fast. And so I will make every decision when I'm designing and building my program so that my program will be fast. Now, there are certain architectural level decisions, certain basic algorithmic choices that you should think about in terms of performance. But low-level coding, you should almost never be thinking about detailed performance. You should be thinking about clear code, easy to understand, fewer bugs. And then after you've built your application, then you can then test it and see, okay, my program is not as fast as I'd like. What are the hot spots? And that's because almost all of your execution time will be taken up by very small portions of your code. So those are the only portions that you really have to optimize for speed.
So this is the whole spend 10% of your time fixing 90% of the problems thing?
Well, normally it's phrased as 80% of your execution time is in 20% of your code, or 90% of your execution time is in 10% of your code. So those sort of rules. So don't spend your time trying to make everything really fast when you actually only need to make that 10% fast in order to make a significant difference. If you ever use a program profiler, you'll see this. It'll tell you where is your program spending its time. It's almost always there are certain routines that are hot spots. And when you find those hot spots, you optimize them, and then you get other hot spots, and then you optimize those, and then you know your optimization, you're not going to have much of a big win when you see that there isn't many things. Now, this is talking about low-level programming, that you can make big mistakes at an architectural level or an algorithmic level where you choose approaches that are just fundamentally slow. So it's not that you don't ever have to, you only think of performance after you built the entire thing. It's just that code-level optimization in general is going to cause you more pain. So, in that context with JavaScript, use the libraries. Libraries are good things. And another big reason to use things like jQuery is that there's lots of stuff built on top of jQuery. For example, Bootstrap uses jQuery. There's this thing called jQuery UI, which has other user interface elements. When I was looking at this stuff for the how to convert the letter paint demo into a full jQuery application, there is this nice thing called jCanvas, which provides a different interface for the HTML canvas, HTML5 canvas. And it's like, oh, wow, different way of doing drawing and stuff. And actually, it does look a lot nicer, the interface. And it's more uniform, but the HTML5 canvas is actually mostly standardized, so not as big a deal, but having a nicer API, that's a win. Now, if you made your game and you found out that this API was slowing you down, then okay, fine, but most of the time it won't be. So before going on, how does jQuery and this sort of thing, do you feel like you have kind of a mental model of how it is? I mean, it's a little fuzzy because you got to see code. I could try walking you through code, but I always find if I walk through code in class, it just gets boring. So I tell the stories in class, and you look at the code tutorial and on your own. But does this seem clear? So maybe I'll stop to say, what are we talking about with HTML5? You probably have heard this term thrown around. What is this? What does that refer to? Any ideas?
It's a new version of the HTML standard, and I know one of the big things is allowing video playback in the browser without having to install Flash.
So HTML5 as a thing is not really a thing. In the sense of, there is not one document that you can say, this is HTML5. This is all the APIs. This is exactly what it is. No. HTML5 refers more to this general movement across the industry to saying, we want lots of technologies built into the browser in a standards way. And they're coming with proposal after proposal after proposal for adding different things to browsers in terms of functionality, and these standards keep coming up. So when people talk about HTML5, they're really talking about, here's this laundry list of technologies that I'd love to have everywhere that we have generally on desktops, and I want them in the browser, and there are varying levels of standardized. One of them is the video element. So why do I have to use a stupid Flash plugin in order to play video? Let me just do it with a video tag. Or maybe I want to be able to do high-quality audio mixing. Or maybe I want to be able to do, the Ajax stuff kind of was originally a background product. Let me do client-side storage. What are some other big... the Canvas widget is HTML5. So let me be able to draw arbitrary 2D or 3D graphics in the browser. Let me be able to do network programming. Let me do sockets. Let me do video chat, WebRTC. I mean, the number of standards that are coming down for this is like almost every use case for what you're going to use a regular, whether it's a desktop or even a touch device, they're trying to incorporate the browser. It's becoming a full platform. And the weird thing about this is before, these sort of APIs and things would be developed just by one company. Like Microsoft said, our desktop is going to function this way, so they implemented all this. Now this is actually people from across the industry implementing these things. I want to mention this is because because there's lots of cool technologies in HTML5, but they are of varying levels of standardization and consistency. Some parts of it are like, okay, everyone implements it. Other parts of it, like, nobody implements it. Other parts of it, well, now the major browsers implement it as of last week. Like, WebRTC is pretty cool. That's basically peer-to-peer audio and video chat. Who needs Skype? My browser can do it for you. But they have interoperability issues. Like, what's the encoding of the video and the audio that you're going to use? What's the exact protocol and things? Like, this stuff is still being worked out. Just recently, Cisco kind of said, so this, you get into things like, you know about codecs, right? You all download stuff off BitTorrent, right? Ever had a codec issue where you downloaded a video that seemed perfectly fine and your computer wouldn't play it? It's because your computer didn't understand the video format. So one of the key things, part of these video formats, it could have been the container format, which is enclosing it, but one big thing of incompatibility is a codec. So codec, compressor, decompressor, I think is, isn't that the other, that's actually what it stands for, but now it's used more as a word on its own. But So in the context of things like video chat or just web video or something, you need to have the right codecs in place to be able to decompress the video or to encode it. Why isn't this standardized? Why is there controversy over this? I mean, we've got image formats, we've got text formats. Why would things like video be a problem?
A lot of the codecs are proprietary.
It's one word, patents. Most of the video things are encumbered by patents. And why are patents a problem is because if there's a patent on something, someone can demand payment for it. But if you can demand payment for it, how can you have it as a standard that everyone can implement? Especially, how can you have open source programs, you know, free programs implement the standard? And so just so the most common, like for video in particular, there's one called H.264. So these, you might notice the names of these things are all really weird because they typically refer to, you know, these are things that come out of standards bodies, you know, from working groups and things, and they all have a history and whatever. But the H.264 standard, MPEG-4, is roughly, you know, what it's, you know, commonly more referred to, is patent encumbered. It means there's a whole consortium of companies that own parts of this patent standard, and that if you want to use it in a commercial application, you technically have to pay them money or get a license from them. Otherwise, they potentially come after and sue you. There are open source implementations of H.264, but if you use them, you have to deal with the patent rights yourself. So I just learned, you know, like last week, or maybe even this weekend or something, there is a recent workaround to allow folks like Firefox and other open source programs use H.264 natively. Anyone heard about this? It's a really silly thing. Yeah.
It was something to do with Cisco Systems, and I don't know if they own patents on it or something.
Cisco Systems has decided to pay the license. They are going to pay multiple millions of dollars for the license to the patents and then give away a library implementing those patents for free. So it's not that Mozilla will be able to distribute a version of Firefox that includes this code. No. What they'll be able to do is distribute Firefox that will go to Cisco's website, download their library, install it into the browser, and use that to decode video. As long as it's hosted by Cisco and Cisco is distributing it, they've paid the license fee, and everyone else can use it. Turns out they're also distributing the source code for this. It's an open source thing. But you can't take the source code and download it and compile it and use it, because then you'd have to pay the patent fee. You instead, as long as you download the object file that Cisco is distributing in an open source project, you're fine. This is the crazy world we live in. It's a very strange thing. So that's why when people talk about video standards and how do you, you know, what do you standardize on, that's what they're talking about. They're talking about patent issues. And you can see with all this amazing functionality, it'd be really cool to be able to do all this. But you can't. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was, based on this all this stuff here, it looks like you can make a web browser do eventually almost anything you can do inside of a regular browser, inside of a regular desktop program. The only difference is it's sandboxed from the underlying system. But it can talk on the network now almost arbitrarily. So, does that make it a desktop application? Is it just, should we just think of web programming when you're on the client side just like a desktop? I think they're watching something over there. Yeah.
It's a lot slower.
A lot slower. Well, how many of you have heard of ASM.js?
Assembly?
Kind of. What ASM.js is a subset of JavaScript. It's a subset of JavaScript that is designed as a compilation target. This means you would take your C or your C++ code or your Java code and compile it to JavaScript. So there's actually a general project for compiling arbitrary code to JavaScript. But this is an advance over it, because in other stuff, sometimes you compile it to JavaScript and the resulting code's a bit slow. ASM.js is a subset of JavaScript such that when you compile down to it, the resulting code can run very, very fast. The just-in-time compilation engine can run it so fast, in fact, that you can get within a factor of two of native code. You notice a factor of two, that doesn't seem good. So like a 50% slowdown. Well, normally with a lot of these things, you're talking about order of like 10 times slowdown or something like that. So this is within spitting distance. You know, a factor of two is within spitting distance of native code speed. So this is an active project by Mozilla. And this is incorporated into the latest Firefox build. So Chrome, they have a separate thing for doing this. But what I'm mentioning this is that, in fact, speed is not so much of an issue. That's not nearly that much of an issue with it at all in terms of execution time. It's getting it's not completely fast, but it's getting faster and faster. And you know, within the next 5 years, it's quite fast right now. The Unreal Engine has been ported to ASM.js.
Distinction between desktop and browser applications is really getting blurred, especially since I think Microsoft has it, so that you can now run Microsoft Office off the cloud. So you're basically running Word or Excel or whatever. You're running it off a program stored on a server somewhere instead of actually having it installed in your own computer.
Has anyone played with Office 365 in a web browser? I mean, how full of a version of Office is it? I actually haven't really looked at that. I've heard of it, but I haven't. Is it complete?
I think Google's Chrome OS is technically, it actually just runs
everything in a browser.
Everything in the cloud. Basically, it starts up next to the internet and then says, okay, and now here's your program, here's your everyday.
So the big difference to realize, well, first off, would you want to download Microsoft Office every time you visited a web page? So there's one fundamental issue with web pages, with web applications, is that the initial thing you download to the client cannot be too big. If you're talking about a normal web page type usage, it's got to be a relatively small bit of code. Now, the size of that has gotten bigger as applications, as you know, connections have gotten faster and stuff. Now, instead of talking about tens of K, we're talking hundreds, megabytes. Those are okay. But they're still much smaller than what you can run on a desktop application. The other thing is that they live in a networked environment. Their persistence cannot be reliably put on the browser itself. The persistence has to be elsewhere. You can cache things locally, but you can't consider that to be reliable storage. It has to be elsewhere. So that means that if you don't, you need a server-side component to add persistence. So what I'll be talking about next time is what does it mean to have desktop-like application, but with this back end there, offering your persistence.